Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us on Hashtag No Limits. Hashtag No Limits is about people whose society has placed limits upon, but who are busting through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, "We know who we are, but not who we will be." And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is not a better example or a more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells, and then it reforms into a butterfly. That's not all the struggle it has to go through. It then has to struggle while it's in the cocoon to get out of the cocoon to make its wings strong enough to be able to fly and take it wherever it wants to go. I can't imagine any of that is easy, but neither is busting through the limits that society places upon a person. And so today I have with me Terry Tucker. And Terry Tucker has a couple of different things, probably more, but a couple of things that we're going to talk about of limits that he has busted through. Terry, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Shelley. I'm looking forward to talking with you today.
Awesome. So what were those kind of two things that I mentioned that we're going to be talking about today of some of the limits that you've busted through in your life?
Well, there are so many, but one we're going to talk about is really somebody else's, what she did to bust through it, and that's our daughter. And then the other thing is my 11 and a half year battle with a rare form of cancer, a rare form of melanoma.
Yeah. So that is the one I think that we want to start with, is this cancer battle. And then all the great things that have come out of that, which sounds like a really strange thing to say, that great things came out of a battling of cancer. So I do want to remind everybody, and Fran has already done this. Hi, Fran. Thanks for joining us. If you're joining us, please put into the comments where you're from and that you're watching hashtag live. If you do happen to watch this in replay, hashtag replay, and let us know where you're from. And just like with Fran, I'll be able to post your comments up so Terry can see them and everyone else can see them. And if you have any questions for us along the way or comments, please let us know. It's so much nicer when you're interacting with us. It just gives us a little extra boost to what we're doing. So Terry, go ahead and talk about that cancer diagnosis and that whole process.
Yeah. So 2012, I have a callus break open on the bottom of my foot. I'm a girls' high school basketball coach in Texas. And so I initially don't think much of it. But after a few weeks of it not healing, I go to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor friend of mine. And he takes an x-ray and says, "Terry, I think you have a cyst in there and I can cut it out." He does, shows it to me, a little gelatin sac with some white fat in it. No dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern. But just out of precaution, he says, "I'll send it off to pathology, but you don't need to worry about anything." 2 weeks later, I received that call that I think we all dread in our lives. And as I said, he was a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he was having explaining to me what was going on, the more frightened I was becoming. Until finally, he just laid it out for me. He said, "Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years, and I have never seen the form of cancer that you have. You have an incredibly rare form of melanoma that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands." And he said, "Because your cancer is so rare, I recommend you go to MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston and be treated." And so I did. But when I was diagnosed, I was basically said, "This is a death sentence. If you get a miracle, you'll live 5 years. More than likely, you'll be dead in two." But Shelley, what doctors don't know is, you know, they don't know that you want to be around for your kid's high school graduation or to walk your daughter down the aisle or to see your grandchildren born. They're playing the odds. They're like Vegas. You know, they know that a person of your age with your stage of cancer probably is going to live X. But they don't know your heart. They don't know your mind, and they don't know your soul. And those things are much more powerful than anything going on in your body. So I said, "Well, you gave me a death sentence. Maybe I can turn this into a life sentence." And so I thought, what can I do to have a purpose? What can I do other than sit around and feel sorry for myself that I have this rare form of cancer that's probably going to kill me? And that started down this journey. They put me on a drug for 5 years where I had a weekly injection that gave me severe flu-like symptoms. So imagine having the flu every week for 5 years. And that
no, thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry, but no thank you.
Yeah. You know, it was bad flu. It was nausea, diarrhea, aches, chills, the whole thing.
Oh my gosh.
And as my doctor said, all we're trying to do is kick the can down the road. This isn't going to cure you. This isn't going to stop the cancer. We're just trying to buy you time because there were no therapies for melanoma other than surgery. Mm-hmm. Now, 11 and a half years later, there's all kinds of therapies. So I do that. I do the interferon. It becomes so toxic to my body that I end up in the intensive care unit with a fever of 108 degrees, which is usually not compatible with being alive. So I had to stop it. And almost immediately, the cancer came back in the exact same spot on my foot where it had presented 5 years earlier. 2018, that necessitated the amputation of my left foot. Cancer works its way up my leg in 19, two more surgeries. And then during the pandemic in 2020, I find out my entire lower leg is full of cancer. I have to have my leg amputated above the knee, and I have tumors in my lungs, which I'm still being treated for. So I know that doesn't sound like a very fun and interesting time, but as you alluded to, I think at the beginning, I don't really think you know yourself until you've been tested by some form of adversity in your life. And the second thing cancer's taught me is it's just made me a better human being.
Wow. I mean, I'm listening to the story and I'm thinking, this is horrible. This is horrible. But here you are talking to me about it. So that's a miracle.
I mean, it's funny because every year MD Anderson sends me a letter from their tumor board continuing to track their patients. And it doesn't really say this, but there are three options on the letter. It's like circle one and send it back to us. You're alive with cancer. You're alive without cancer. Or you're dead. And I keep hanging around because I haven't figured out how to circle number three yet. So, you know, I do get that letter, but that number three is said in a little easier way. So.
Right. No, but that's great. I mean, if you can't figure out how to do it, you can't do it, right? So exactly. You're just going to keep hanging on until you figure it out. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's funny. So, I mean, unfortunately, I have known way too many people with cancer. And I have known way too many people who have passed away because of that cancer. I have known a lot of people who have had cancer and have beat the cancer, but it seems like that number is so much smaller than those who have faced it and had their life taken away because of it. So as I said, sitting here listening to your story, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, how awful. But yet there's I kind of had a bit of a joy because I'm getting to talk to you about this. And these are the kinds of stories that I love to tell. The underdog story, defeating all the odds, you know, now you haven't completely won because you said you still have some nodules in your lungs and, you know, you're still having to deal with it, but this is a triumphal story, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, given that, you know, they're telling me I'm going to die in a few years and here I am 11 and a half years later, still functioning. I mean, granted, they keep lopping off body parts that, you know, I kind of need that. Could you hang on to it and stuff like that? But no, you learn to adapt. And as you probably figured out, one of the ways I adapt is through humor. You know, I laugh at this. I make fun of it. I self-deprecate. I remember when I had my foot amputated, I was in this boot contraption and I was walking out of the hospital. Walking is kind of a loose term there. And there was a woman at the exit who was just, you've seen those people that just sort of stare right through you. You know, they're just, you know, trying to burn a hole right through you. And I looked around like, is she looking at me? And there was nobody else around. So as I got up to her, she was continuing to stare. And just as I got to her, I turned and I looked at her and I said, don't worry, it'll grow back. And I kept walking, you know, and I looked over my shoulder and she had this look on her face like, is this guy like some kind of a salamander or something? You know, you kind of crop off their tail and it grows back and stuff.
Right.
But it's that kind of, it's like, you know what? I'm dealing with this. You don't need to stare so hard. And it's right. Like, but I get it. You're uncomfortable. Like, what is this guy doing? He doesn't have a foot. It's pretty obvious. But can you laugh at yourself through this stuff? And I just find humor is one of the best ways to kind of break the ice, especially when, you know, you come around people, you're in a wheelchair, you have no leg. it makes people uncomfortable. Well, let me make a joke about it and see if we can sort of break the ice a little bit and get to connect with each other as human beings.
Right. So Fran has a great question. What kept you focused on living?
I talk about three things, which are my three F's, which are faith, family, and friends. I have a very strong faith in God. And when I was on that interferon for 11 years or for 5 years, I really felt that there were sort of two camps. There was, I was living or I was not dying. And I was definitely in the not dying category. I didn't really feel I was contributing. I mean, winning the day sometimes was literally, I got to get out of bed and I've got to make it to the couch. That was winning the day. And I know some people are like, really? That's, yeah. But when you're that sick and you feel that horrible, that's literally winning the day. So, you know, you just get to a point where, you know, there's got to be something bigger than you. And I was like, look, God, okay, I'm not contributing to anything. Please take me out of this. And he didn't. But I think what he did was give me the strength to go on. And when I had these tumors in my lungs, I was losing my leg. My oncologist about 6 months later showed me my CAT scan. And I have no medical background. I don't know how to read a CAT scan. But you can kind of look at it and say, well, that sure doesn't look like it belongs there. You know. And I had these big tumors in my lungs. They had fluid all around the pleural spaces. And I remember looking at my oncologist and saying, how was I alive? And Shelly, I'll never forget. I still can see him. He put his head down. He sort of shook his head no. And then he looked up at me and he said, I don't know, because you shouldn't have been. Which said to me that God's not done with me yet. You know, when I die, where I die, how I die, way above my pay grade. So that was one thing. My family is incredibly important to me. You know, I'm dealing with the physical part of cancer. They're dealing with the emotional, the psychological part of knowing somebody they love is in pain, is losing body parts, is having surgery, is doing all this stuff. I think that's almost harder than what I'm going through, having them to deal with. You know, they're not dealing with the physical part. They're dealing with the emotional part. And then my friends, you know, my friends are, there are people that I was 100% sure that would be in the foxhole with me, that would never let go, that said, Terry, I can't deal with you. I can't deal. You know, you're 51 years old. You've got this terminal disease. I can't deal with it. And they backed off. And then there were people that I never expected to be there for me that have never left my side during these 11 and a half years. So faith, family, and friends is really what keeps me living, keeps me moving forward.
That's beautiful. And I love that you start with faith. Because to me, my faith is such an integral part of everything that I do in every day. My hope is always that people see something in me and ask me what that is.
And for me, it was, you know, to kind of piggyback on that, you know, I started playing, your audience can't tell us, but I'm 6'8" tall. And I went to college on a basketball scholarship. So I started playing basketball when I was 9, and I played all the way up until I was 21 when I graduated from college. And one of the things that I think team sports taught me, and for me it was sports, I think it can be whatever team you're on, is the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. You know, you realize that on a team that if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, but you let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down, et cetera. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life.
Yeah, that's very true. So Fran says, faith, family, friends are great foundations for living, since she thanks you for your answer.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great analogy. And I truly appreciate what you said about that. You think it might be harder on those who are going through it emotionally than the person who's going through it physically. I often think the same thing when I see either, you know, myself being the caregiver or others being caregivers to loved ones, that, you know, we that are walking alongside are, we can't know exactly what the person is feeling and what their thoughts are. And we have our own thoughts and we have our own feelings. And sometimes we feel guilty because we have some of the thoughts and the feelings that we do. I try to give myself grace and, you know, let other people know, like, your thoughts are your thoughts. Selfish thoughts are going to come in. You're worried about yourself as well as your person that you're caregiving for. And yeah, I mean, we we that are caregivers in the moment, no matter, you know, I mean, that could be you in other situations. You want to take that, whatever that is, away from that loved one. And we can't. And I think that's the hardest part for those of us that are caregivers in those moments.
I would agree with you. I mean, when I had my leg amputated, it was right in the middle of COVID. And I remember my wife dropping me off at the hospital and was like, what do I do? And it was like, well, you can't come in with me. You know, you can't be with me. I'm going to lose my leg, but I have no support here. And I said, just go out in the parking lot and pray until you hear from the doctor. I didn't know. I felt, you know, I was going to have my leg amputated, but I felt worse for her than I felt for me, you know, because it was, I know how empty, how lonely you must feel right now, where my husband's going to have his leg amputated and I can't do anything about it. I can't even be there to hold his hand because of this pandemic.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great point too, because that's like, you know, one of the things that I always kind of give myself solace of is, well, I may not be able to physically, you know, take something away, but at least I can be here and be supportive and listen. And like you said, hold that hand. And in that situation, that wasn't even possible. So, oh, your poor wife, that that hurts my heart just thinking about that for her. How exactly lonely that must have been for her. And yet, like I said, if she felt that way, she was probably thinking, well, how selfish of me to be worried about me when my husband's in there having his leg amputated. You know, it's just this roller coaster of emotions. Yeah. Wow. And so, somewhere in that, you came up with this sustainable excellence idea. Where and how did that manifest during all of this?
Yeah, so the book Sustainable Excellence was really born out of two conversations I had. You know, I mentioned I was a girls' high school basketball coach when we lived in Texas, and I had had a former player who had moved to the area in Colorado with her fiance, where my wife and I lived. And the four of us had dinner one night. And I remember after dinner saying to her that I was really excited that she was living close and I could watch her find and live her purpose. And she got real quiet for a while. And then she looked at me and she said, well, coach, what do you think my purpose is? And I remember saying, I have no idea what your purpose is, but that's what your life should be about. Finding the reason you were put on the face of this earth, using your unique gifts and talents, and living that reason. So that was one conversation. And then I had a young man reach out to me on social media, and he asked me what I thought were the most important things that he should learn, not to just be successful in his job or in business, but to be successful in life. You know, and Shelley, I didn't want to give him that, you know, get up early, work hard, help others. I didn't want to give him sort of the cliches that we all know. I wanted to see if I could go deeper with him. So I spent some time and I was taking some notes, and eventually I had these 10 ideas, these 10 thoughts, these 10 principles. And so I sent them to him. And then I stepped back and I was like, well, I've got a life story that fits underneath that principle, or I know somebody's life who emulates this principle. So literally during that 4-month period or so where I was healing after I had my leg amputated, I sat down at the computer and I built stories, and they're real stories about real people. And that's how Sustainable Excellence came to be.
Awesome. So I want to let everyone know who is watching either live or in the replay that you have an opportunity to win this awesome book that Terry has just talked about. And the way that you can enter in to win is you subscribe to the YouTube channel, share this episode either on YouTube or Facebook, and then just comment on the thread. So Fran has already done one of those things. She's already commented. So she's well on her way to being entered in for this drawing. And so anyone else, and so how I do this is, because I don't want this to run forever, so today is Tuesday, November 21st. And so if you do those three steps by Monday, which would be November 27th, right? So November 27th, if you do those three steps, then you will be entered into the drawing to win this awesome book. And Terry and I will connect you with Terry in order to make that happen. So, and the sharing it, then you're just going to give, you know, other people the opportunity to hear Terry's amazing journey here, but also to learn more about him through his book as well. So what are the doctors saying for, and I just want to pop this up. Fran says it took a stroke for her to find her purpose. That's incredible. Thank you, Fran, for sharing that. So what is the prognosis? I guess you probably had the same prognosis you had 11 and a half years ago. It's like, we really don't know because this is so rare and there's not been a lot of people, but what are you anticipating in your future with this cancer?
Then it'll probably take my life, in all honesty. I am on a clinical trial drug now that I started out with two other people at the University of Colorado hospitals. Those people have both passed away from their cancer. For some reason, I'm still going. And the interesting part of this trial is that this is a drug that does absolutely nothing to the cancer. It's not like a chemotherapy, you know, that goes in and kills the cells. What it does is, or the way cancer proliferates in the body is it secretes an enzyme, a protein that basically hides itself from your immune system. And what this drug does is goes in and wipes out that protein or that enzyme so that my own immune system can, just like a cold or a flu virus, can say, oh, hey, that's something foreign. That doesn't belong here. We should go attack it. So it's your own immune system that's helping you to fight the disease as opposed to, you know, giving you a chemotherapy drug where the drug does that. But, you know, with chemotherapy, it's sort of the shotgun approach. Yeah, it might take out the cancer, but it's also going to take out, you know, the lining of your stomach and your intestines and your hair and all that kind of stuff. So this is more targeted. And so for the last 3 years now, 3 years last month, I have been every 3 weeks going to the hospital, being infused with the drug every day for 5 days in a row, and then getting 2 weeks off. And the tumors are still there, but they're stable. I'm sure at some point in time they're going to break out, but you know, I feel good. I'm lucky. I'm fortunate that I'm still here. And so prognosis wise, I don't know. I mean, we're all going to die, whether I die of this or something else. I don't know.
Right. And that's kind of one of the things that I've mentioned on this show before is, you know, my whole intent, well, not the whole intent, but a lot of the intent of doing hashtag no limits is to help people see that we shouldn't focus on another's differences, but focus on their abilities, focus on the things that are the same with amongst us. And having you on today, I hope, is giving that perspective of, you know, you can be joyful even in the midst of bad news. I'm sure you're not happy every day. I'm sure you're not happy every minute of every day. And can you just talk about that a little bit? Like, how do you get yourself out of those times? And, you know, what is it? I mean, I know you don't wallow in it. But do you allow yourself to feel those moments?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you're looking at me right now. There's no S on my chest. I do not have a cape and fly around with magical powers by any means. Yeah, I'm a human being, you know, and I don't, as much as I like to think I'm strong and tough and all that kind of stuff, I have those bad days, especially during treatment. It really kind of brings my emotions to the surface. So there are times when I'll cry. There are times, you know, when I'll just feel like, you know, why is this happening? Why, you know, what's going on here? And when that happens, I think of two stories. And I always remind myself of these stories. The first one is about a professor at Johns Hopkins University back in the 1950s who did a very simple experiment with rats. And as soon as I say that, people are like, rats, we're going to talk about rats. Right? Yeah. Hang with me. I promise the story's worth rats. What he did is he took rats and he put them in a tank of water that was over their head. And he wanted to see how long the average rat could tread water. And initially, the rats treaded water for about 15 minutes. And just as they were getting ready to sink and drown, he reached in, grabbed them, pulled them out, dried them off, and let them rest for a while. And then he took those exact same rats and put them back in that exact same tank of water. And the second time around, on average, those rats treaded water for 60 hours. Now think about that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. First time, 15 minutes. You know, it wasn't like you're going to flunk a test or your business was going to go in. You were going to die. Your life was going to be over. And the second time around, 60 hours, which said to me two things. Number one, the importance of hope. in our lives that we have to believe, maybe not today, maybe not next week, maybe not even this year, but if we know we're doing the right thing, sometime in the future, we're probably going to get to where we want to be. No guarantees, but we probably are. That's hope. And the second thing it taught me was just how much more our physical bodies can handle than we ever thought they could. Now, don't get me wrong. I think everybody has a breaking point, but that breaking point is usually so much further down the road than we ever thought it was. We quit. We give up. We give in long before our bodies do. And that's because our mind's telling us, oh, this hurts. It's uncomfortable. Stop it. So that's one story. And the second story that kind of dovetails with that is I have a friend of mine, actually a young man who works with my wife, who's a former Navy SEAL, some of the toughest men in the military. And the SEALs talk about what they call their 40% rule, which says if you're done, if you're at the end of your rope, if you can't go on, you're only at 40% of your maximum, and you still have another 60% left in reserve to give to yourself. So whenever I get into those dark and ugly and down places, and I do, I think about those stories and they motivate me. They give me the resolve to just, I just got to put one foot in front of the other and see where that takes me.
Wow. Those are two amazing stories. And the Navy SEAL one, I kind of knew a little bit of it. I didn't know the exact numbers. And the story about the professor at Johns Hopkins, I've never heard that. That is phenomenal. I mean, again, I think that comes back to your faith. The fact that, and I've seen studies about this, that people who have a faith tend to live longer and heal faster than people who don't when they have had, you know, some big diagnosis of something. And I think that that hope that those of us who have faith cling to, it makes me sad when I think that there are people out there that don't have that. And I don't think it's a crutch, which is a lot what a lot of people say. Oh, what you believe in, you know, whatever it is that you believe in, a God that you can't see and who, you know, does this or that. Well, that's just a crutch. Why do you need that? Well, I mean, scientifically, you just, even if it's not about faith, scientifically, it improves your life.
It does.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's funny because when people found out I had cancer, and I think, and I can only sort of speak to the West, you know, that people were asking me like, well, oh, you got cancer. Who do you blame? I'm like, well, what do you mean? Who do I blame? Like, well, you must blame somebody. We're great in this country, you know, and in the West, I think we start down the road toward a goal and then we butt up against an impediment. Something gets in our way and we can't get over it, around it, or through it. So we quit. But we just don't quit. Now we got to blame somebody. You know, very few people take personal responsibility for their own success and happiness. So we got to blame our parents or our boss or our station in life. So people are like, well, who do you blame? Because you got cancer. So I don't blame anybody. And then when they find out, excuse me, that I have a faith life, it's like, well, you must blame God. And I used to say to him, no, I don't think God got up on a Tuesday morning, checked his to-do list and said, Terry Tucker, cancer today. You know, I don't believe that at all. But I do believe he has given me the strength to get through these 11 and a half years. I am 100% sure, and I believe this in my soul, that I would not be here if it wasn't for, as I talked before, my faith, my family, and my friends.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Yeah. I've never heard that people say, who do you blame for your cancer? That's interesting. I'm in the Midwest, so I don't know if that's different based on where we are, but that's very interesting. So we've talked a lot about your faith and getting your faith having your faith getting you through a lot of this. And we mentioned at the beginning that there were two main reasons that you made a perfect guest for Hashtag No Limits. Obviously, the limits that you are busting through. I mean, first of all, you know, that you had this diagnosis of this extremely rare cancer that, you know, they maybe gave you a couple of years to live. And here you are 11 and a half years later, a couple of amputations later. You've written a book. You are a motivational speaker, over 600 podcasts. You know, I mean, the inspiration that you have provided through all of those podcasts, plus just your family and friends that are around you. So thank you for all of that. And I want to move into your family a little bit more because we did mention your daughter at the beginning. So tell us about your daughter.
So our daughter, you know, me having a daughter, you don't understand how crazy that is. I grew up with two brothers. I have no sisters. I went to an all-boys Catholic high school in Chicago. I went to an all-male military college at the Citadel. So when my wife was pregnant, we went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Do you want to know the sex of the baby?" And we were all excited. Yeah, sure. It's like, "Well, you should buy pink." And I was like, "Oh, no. You need to leave it in there till it's done. I have no idea what to do with a girl." And my daughter and I have an amazing relationship. She, fortunately or unfortunately, got my height and is 6'2", also got my affinity for playing basketball. But when she was in middle school, she was diagnosed with dyslexia, an attention disorder, and an anxiety disorder, which we had her tested. And so she learns differently. You know, I remember my mom, you know, I'd have the radio on when I was studying. I, you know, shut off the radio and stuff. But our daughter learns with color. Our daughter learns with music and things like that. So things that are not necessarily traditional. So fast forward, comes time, you know, she manages to overcome this. She works with a learning specialist. Now it's time to go to college. And she had an opportunity to play basketball at the United States Air Force Academy. The only problem is the service academies, you don't get the accommodations you get in high school and grade school where you can take tests, you know, by yourself. You can have longer to take tests. It's like, yeah, sorry, you're with everybody else. You either sink or swim. And so, you know, our daughter was like, "Well, I don't know. This is a pretty good opportunity." You know, as a parent, you're like, "Yeah, this is your decision. You decide where you want to go. You go to school." And, you know, I'm like pulling my hair out, like, "Oh my God, this is a tremendous opportunity. Please take this." But I didn't say that. I said, "It's your choice." And so she took it. And I'll tell you, I may get emotional here. The best day I think my wife and I would agree that we ever had was that day back in 2019 when she walked across the stage at Falcon Stadium. Got her diploma and shook hands with the President of the United States. So, pretty amazing.
Yeah. And so dyslexia and attention disorder and anxiety, those are three huge things to struggle through. And she's not finished. If I recall from when we chatted, several months ago, because you were supposed to be on in October and then I had to cancel, and I'm so happy that you rescheduled with me. But when we talked prior to then, like she's continuing to do amazing things. While that was a high point, there have been a few other high points since then.
Yeah, she got married. She married one of her classmates from the Air Force Academy. He's a pilot. She's an officer in the new branch of the military, the Space Force. You know, which is kind of going through its growing pains, you know, trying to figure out its role and things like that. And she's just, you know, there comes a time where I think your kids sort of, if you're lucky, they outpace you. And she certainly has. I mean, you know, I was talking to her the other day. What are you doing? I'm learning French. You're what? I'm learning French. Like, you're learning the French language? Yes. Why? Well, I just want to. I mean, just. And I think that's what's so great. And I think that's one of the things that we tend to lose as we get older is that curiosity, that need to be a lifelong learner. You know, I want to know things about things that I don't understand or that I don't know about. I want to figure them out. And so many of us, I think, get to a point where it's like, all right, I know enough. I'm good. You know, I graduated from high school, college, whatever you did. You know, I know enough. I want to die learning. I mean, that should be my last. I'm reading a book, I die. You know, I want to die learning. And that's what she's doing. You know, I just wanted to study French. And so now, and she's taking French. I'm like, God love you. You know, I mean, literally, you know, it's just, I just look at her and I see, you know, young people get, you know, sort of, you know, gut punched all the time about how lousy they are, you know. But you look at, I look at people like our daughter, and this is going to sound self-serving, but even the people she graduated with, it's like, these are the people that are our future. These are the people that, you know, understand adversity. I mean, I'll never forget two stories. She called home one time and she said, I'm going to cry if I tell you this story.
It's okay.
And she said, you know, Mom, Dad, I'm so glad I have the relationship I do with you because so many kids here don't like their parents. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited about that. You know, I was so like yeah. we have a relationship. We have an adult relationship. It's not, oh, you're my kid and I don't like you. We have a good relationship. And I think we fostered that. We gave her discipline. We gave her love. We gave her values. We gave her faith. And it was like, okay, you figure it out for yourself. And I'm old, so I totally forgot the second story I was going to tell you. But
it's okay. It might come back to you.
It might. Probably in the shower. yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, my daughter just turned 24 and, you know, she's living out on her own. She's graduated college with two degrees and a minor and extremely independent. But we love to spend time with her and she loves to spend time with us. And exactly what you said, you know, we gave her that structure growing up. We gave her the foundation that she needed and she is soaring from that foundation. And, you know, is everything perfect in her life? No, it's not perfect in anyone's life, but she knows how to handle the struggles. She knows, I mean, her work ethic, I was just talking to her earlier and, you know, I said, she's thinking about if what she's doing right now is what she always want to do for the rest of her life. And she's worried that she won't find something else. And I said, you have an amazing work ethic. There's so many people, like you said, their generation gets gut punched a lot. But it sounds like your daughter and my daughter are the same in the fact that they'll work. They'll put in the effort that's needed. They'll show up when they need to show up. They'll do the things that they need to do. And I said, so that is going to take you further than, because she's worried that her degree isn't going to take her very far. And I said, it's not so much that your degree is in something as when you show up and you show them how good you are and that you are willing to get in and get dirty and do the hard work necessary. And so I'm like you, I'm very proud of our daughter and the things that she's accomplished. And like I said, she's only 24. She has a lifetime ahead of her yet.
Right. But having that ethic is so important. And it sounds like you taught her that. And I do remember the other story. You know, our daughter made the comment to my wife one time. She said, you know, going to the service, going to the Air Force Academy, you know, going through basic training and all the stuff you have to do to go through that. She made the comment. She's like, well, I'm going to do the hard stuff now when I'm young and hopefully gain or reap the rewards that doing those hard things, doing those difficult things get me down the line. And I thought, for a kid to understand that, you know, at your daughter's age, my daughter's age, my daughter's 27, so, you know, they're pretty close in age.
Right.
To understand that, you know, I've got something here that so many people don't, and I can use that to basically make my life whatever I want it to be.
And you've been such a great example to her. It was an unfortunate way to be an example to her, but that you are doing very difficult things the last 11 and a half years. And you are facing that adversity and you're facing it with everything that you've got, but with joy that, you know, I'm just going to keep living. You know, as long as I'm here, I'm going to do what I can do until God takes me home.
Exactly. And you know, I talked about faith, family, and friends. And, you know, the story that I didn't tell you was, you know, when I had my leg amputated, my doctor wanted to put me on chemotherapy. You know, and I looked at him like, is it going to save my life? And he's like, nah, probably not, but it might buy you some more time. And I said, you know, I was 8 years into this journey. I said, well, if I'm going to die anyway, I think I would rather spend whatever time I have left, you know, kind of having my faculties about me, but I'll go home and talk to my family. And I go home and I start telling my wife and daughter about this. And my daughter's like, okay, we need a family meeting. I'm like, family meeting, there's three of us. It's not like there's four here, you know. So we end up sitting around the kitchen table and individually talking about how we all feel about me having chemotherapy. And then when we're done with that, my daughter's like, all right, let's take a vote. How many people want dad to have chemotherapy? And my wife and daughter raise their hand. I'm like, wait a minute. Am I getting all voted for something that I don't want to do? But I remembered when I was back in the police academy, our defensive tactics instructor used to have us bring a photograph of the people we love the most, the class. And as we were learning different techniques to defend ourselves, we were to look at that photograph because he reasoned you will fight harder for the people you love than you will fight for yourself. So I took chemotherapy, not because I wanted to, but because I love my wife and daughter more than I love myself. And in hindsight, it was the right thing to do. It was the bridge that got me to the drug I'm on now. But if you would have said that 8 years ago, I wouldn't have been here talking to you if it hadn't been for them.
Right. And I love that she just kind of took charge of the situation.
Yeah. Like when your family, feeling me, you're like, we're just talking. No, we got to, you know, like, are we going to call roll or what? You know,
right? Yeah, that might have been a little bit of that Air Force training coming out. Well, and kudos to her for choosing the Air Force. That's the branch that my husband was in, and we always like to tease all the other branches. You know, that the Air Force is the best branch because they take care of their officers and their enlisted. And, you know, we have family members who were Army and Marines and Navy. And so, yeah, we were Air Force. My husband was Air Force. I was not able to be in the military, but he likes to talk about, you know, the kind of meals that they had and the kind of basic that they went through. And, but that, you know, the Air Force is more the intelligent branch is what we like to say. So
I would agree with you.
We might
play each other in football or something like that.
Right.
Army, Navy, Air Force, Army. Yeah. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The Marines, they can be the brawn. The Air Force will be the intelligent.
Exactly. We'll
go from there. Yeah. So I'm having such a good time. I would like, though, to talk a little bit more about, like, what was it like for you and your wife? Obviously, your daughter must have been struggling that you went ahead and had her assessed. So what was it like from your parent perspective of her struggles? I don't know that I've really ever asked a parent that, because this is kind of that caregiver role that we were talking about before. Like how much more difficult it can sometimes be on the caregiver.
Yeah, you know, what bothered us was that teachers were seeing this. Like she would not do well on a test, but then the teacher would call her up to the desk and basically ask her the questions that were on the test. And she could recite the answer. She knew the material, but was unable to somehow get it on paper. And part of that was due to her attention. You know, if there was somebody out in the hall fixing a light, you know, her attention was drawn to that and away from what she was concentrating on. And teachers had known that for a while, but hadn't said anything. And we were, you know, all of a sudden we get this meeting request and okay, fine. And here's the deal. And they gave us a psychologist and the psychologist was a superwoman. We still stay in touch with her. And it was like, okay, we're going to do all these testing. And we had to do testing. My wife and I had to do testing as well as part of the entire package.
Wow.
And the interesting thing about it was when we went back to school, one of the teachers said, well, what medication is she on? And we were like, excuse me? Well, what medication is she on? It's like, she's not on any medication. She doesn't need medication. She just learns differently and is working with a learning specialist. And the psychologist recommended a learning specialist. So it was like, look, and I mean, you know, she was in middle school. So there was always I don't want to go to the learning specialist, you know.
Sure.
But it was like, okay, we're the parents. Sorry, we're not your friends. This is something you need to do, and we're going to make you do it. And you may not like it, and you may have a tantrum and all that kind of stuff. But in the end, this is going to be what's, you know, we want you to get to where you are playing to your strengths and that you are doing what you want to do. We don't want you limited because you didn't get the help and the assistance you needed. And so we did. I mean, I used to pick her up from school 2 days a week. We went to a learning specialist. I sat in the waiting room, read a book. She went back with the learning specialist. And the funny thing about it is, even today, the learning specialist has this photograph of our daughter in her Air Force Academy uniform up on the board in her office. And it is a tool she uses for kids to say, this person on my board had the same learning issues that you had. Because they always look at her in a uniform and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Who is that person? And she uses her as an example of, if you work hard at this, this is something that you might be able to get to do as well. So there was no ifs, ands, buts about, you know, we didn't blame the teachers. We didn't blame the school. No, our daughter has this. We don't know why she has it. I mean, hopefully we didn't contribute to it, but she has these things. Let's get it taken care of. And even today, she is still in touch at 27 years old with the woman who was the learning specialist that she worked with back in middle school.
That's awesome. Yeah. So there's that blame question again. Like, who do you blame? Well, you don't blame anybody. It's just part of life.
Yeah.
You know, it is who she is. And why would we love her as she is? So what blame would there be? You know, that's kind of a strange question. But I hear that often, you know, like, well, and I know as parents, and especially as a mom, because we've carried the baby, you know, and it's always mom's fault. Well, you know, she did this while she was pregnant or that while she was pregnant. And so we do tend to carry that a little bit more, but your daughter, my daughter, you, myself, we are exactly who we are supposed to be.
Right.
And our genetics are the way that God intended us to be. And so to say that somebody would be to blame for that, takes away from who we are, I think.
It does. But I mean, I remember, you know, when my mom and dad used to go to parent teacher conference, it was always, we better get a good report or, you know, you're going to have some explaining to do when we come home. Kind of thing.
Sure.
So, you know, I mean, today, because both my brothers are in education, it's the parents not accepting responsibility and making it the teachers or the school's fault for their kids. Why does my kid have an F in there? Well, they never show up to class. They don't do the assignments. I'll give you the reasons. Well, it's not my fault. You're a parent. That's what you're supposed to parent.
Right.
And young people sometimes ask me, you know, what do you recommend? And I always tell them, it's like, look, you're the parent. You're not their friend. You know, I know you want to be their friend, but you got to make the tough decisions. You got to make the tough calls. No, you're not going to that party because, you know, their parents aren't going to be home or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And yes, they're going to stomp up the stairs and they're going to slam the door and they're going to say they hate you. But then you're going to say, yeah, I understand that, but I'm doing this because I love you. And that's your job. That's what you're supposed to do as a parent.
Well, and here you have the great example. I mean, you just mentioned that when she was in middle school, she didn't want to go to the learning specialist. No. And now here she is, you know, 15 years later, maybe I'm doing good math there, 12, 15 years later. And she's still in contact with this person because she knows how valuable that person was to her at that point in her life. And as a parent, you know, we can't see the future, but we can kind of predict the future better than our middle schoolers or our elementary or even our high schoolers. You know, and I can go into the whole, you know, how the brain develops part of that and the scientific reasoning behind all of it, but just trust us, you know, that your children need you to be their parent until they get a certain age, an adult age. And then you can, when you don't need to parent them anymore, when it's time for all of your fruits of your labor to blossom. And I mean, our jobs as parents is to work ourselves out of jobs.
Exactly. Right.
And so if your child is able to do that, then you have to let them do that. And even if they're not as able maybe as other people, there is some level at which they are able to not need to be parented anymore. And you can have that relationship, that friend relationship at that point. But until you reach that point, you have to make their decisions for them. You have to guide them into making good decisions.
Yeah, because as you know, the prefrontal cortex isn't formed completely. You know, I mean, any little shiny thing that comes along, they're distracted and they go after it. And that's where you as a parent need to say, no, that's not good for you. You know, those people aren't good for you. And I, you know, if somebody were to ask me what's the most important thing that a kid can do to be successful in life, I would say, figure out the people you surround yourself with. You know, if you surround yourself with people that are good and kind and caring and, you know, educated and want to be better, then you'll be good and kind and caring and want to be better. Versus if you're hanging around with people that are, you know, it's all about them, it's all about drama, nothing's ever good, nothing's ever positive, then you'll turn out that way too. The people you hang around with absolutely will determine where you go in your life.
Yeah, for sure. Make sure you're finding people who are supporting you and lifting you up and not pushing you down or holding you back.
Right.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. So Terry, I can't thank you enough, for rescheduling. I'm so thankful that you were able to be here. And your story is amazing. And I can understand why you've been on so many podcasts. And I wish you much success in battling and living with the cancer that you have. I want to give you opportunity here, though, before we say goodbye, to lay out anything else that you've had on your heart to say and we haven't gotten to yet today.
Yeah, I'll leave you with this story. You know, I think a lot of us at times think that our journey, our value, or our story has no value. And I can absolutely tell you that it does. I remember reading an article recently that said 83% of Americans that were polled felt that they had a book inside them, whether it was a memoir or whether it was a fiction book. And yet less than 1% of those people will ever write that book. So here's the story. I'm treated at the infusion center at the University of Colorado. And at this particular time, there was a young nurse. She was about 25 years old. She was already a nurse, but she was being trained, precepted on how to do things in the unit. About 6 months later, she's taking care of me by herself. And she comes in and she says, Terry, I got a story I want to tell you, but I'm a little uncomfortable telling it to you. And I was like, I didn't know how to respond to that. You know, it's like, well, I said, I hope you decide you want to tell me. I'm sure I would enjoy hearing it. So the next couple of hours, she's in and out and finally comes in, sits down. And she said, all right, here's the story. She said, when I first met you, she said, I was going to get out of nursing. She said, I had a very good friend of mine die. I was in a really dark place. I talked to my mom and dad. I was going to quit nursing. I was going to go to work for Amazon. And she said, and then I met you. And she said, and I see what you go through, how you react terribly to all your medication and your infusions. And she said, then I went back in the computer and I read your file. I read everything that you had been through. And she said, when I finished reading it, I knew I was where I was supposed to be. Now, if she would have never told me that story, I would have had no idea that my life had had a positive impact on hers. I can promise everybody who's listening to us, I don't care how bad things are for you. I don't care how down in the dumps you are or how lousy life is. There is somebody you may know, somebody you may not know, somebody who may be watching you sort of, I know this sounds kind of creepy, from afar, but watching how you handle your struggles, your adversity with the courage that you put forward and would give almost anything they have to walk in your shoes for just 5 minutes. So don't think your life doesn't have meaning. Don't think your story doesn't have value. If you feel you've got that book inside you, write the book. I can promise you there'll be somebody out there that will benefit from your story.
Absolutely. And Fran says your story is powerful and full of faith. Thank you for being real.
Thank you, Fran.
And I concur again. I'm so appreciative of you being with me today. And to the audience, again, remember, if you want to take a chance to get his book, let me just pop this up again. So you enter the drawing by subscribing to my YouTube channel, sharing this episode on either YouTube or Facebook, and then just commenting on the thread. So right now, Fran is the winner because, you know, she's done at least well, and she's already a YouTube subscriber. I know that. So so all she's got to do, the next thing she's got to do is share it, and then she'll be our winner for today. But make sure that, you know, you, anybody who's watching, that you do that. Terry, your story is so incredible and so inspiring, and I hope that many people in my audience share your story out, purchase your book, and where can they purchase your book? You know what? I'm so sorry. I didn't even put up your website yet. That is motivationalcheck.com. And so you can go out there and order your book, or where can they get your book?
You can. It'll take you to the Amazon link. You can get Sustainable Excellence anywhere you get a book online, Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, Apple iBooks. You can just Google it. It'll pop up.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much, everyone. Joining me today and in the replays, make sure you join next week as well. I have another author, Lori Bell. She is a local author to me, and she has written fiction books for years. She has, I think, 37 or 38 fiction books out. But over the summer, she wrote an autobiography of her own life with her child who has autism. It is an amazing read, and I want you to come back next week and join me when Lori Bell joins me. Everybody have, and by the way, this is Thanksgiving week for the live stream. When this comes out in the podcast, I don't know when it'll be, but happy Thanksgiving to everyone. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family, Terry. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.